This is Digital Music Trends 164 on the 1st of January 2014. This week on the show, a recap of DMT's interviews recorded on location at conferences around the world in 2013. You can find the full interviews as well as many more are recorded on youtube.com/digitalmusictrends and soundcloud.com/digitalmusictrends. Hello everyone and Happy New Year! Welcome to Digital Music Trends 2013 interviews recap from conferences around the world, including extracts from MIDEM, South by Southwest, the World Creators Summit, Future Music Camp, Ames Music Connected and the Ultimate Seminar. It was a busy year for DMT, but it's going to be an even busier one in 2014 as I'm planning to bring you lots of new shows and cover as many events as humanly possible. As I mentioned in the past couple of shows, if you tune in every week and would like to contribute, there's now an option for a voluntary subscription on digitalmusictrends.com, and the proceeds will go mostly towards covering operational costs, including server space for the shows. And we start the tour with my chat with international classical music star Lang Lang at MIDEM 2013, talking about streaming, social media, and more. First of all, let's talk about how music is consumed. Social media, you're a big proponent of social media, and you are on Twitter and Facebook a lot. How do you see people really engaging with not just yourself but also your music through channels like Spotify and all these new streaming sites that are out there?
I think all those new platforms such as Spotify, I think it's a very cool idea.
Yeah.
And and we all create pages, personal artist pages on those wonderful new platform for distributing music.
Absolutely.
And I think we need that, actually. We actually need the platform to share classical music.
Yeah.
And not only music itself, but also educational component.
Sure.
I think it's also important, like masterclass, the educational events.
Yeah.
Very creative programs.
Absolutely.
So I think there are many things we can still,
with those
ideas.
Of course. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about being in a studio and recording an album? How do you go about that process? And do you get involved at all in the sound of your piano and how your piano sounds in the recording?
Yeah, I think more and more I'm getting involved. The first recording, you talk to your producer and get a lot of great suggestion from, the recording team.
Yeah.
But then, you listen many years later, you're recording your current album, you find how do you change from those years and what's the process. And now, obviously, when I make a recording, I have something to say about what kind of sound I want it to hear.
Yeah.
Which is very important. Otherwise, you will never find yourself.
No.
You need to have certain identity from your recordings.
Yeah.
It's a different than live recording. It's very different. When you are in the studio, there's a lot of rooms you can try to really being part of the recreation. And that's the fun part in the studio.
Yeah.
Today, if you're not happy, stop making a recording and come back tomorrow. Not like concert. You, no matter how happy or how sad you are, you need to play well.
Absolutely.
So it's a different situation.
Sure. Also, there's a lot of applications on the iPad coming out, for example. And tablets that are helping people to learn music. But of course, there's a piece of the puzzle, which is the teacher, which really needs to be central still to music education, because technology cannot replace humanities and teachers.
It's hard to replace. I mean, seriously, we can do a lot of fun projects. As I also done a lot of things on apps before. But the real concert in a real concert hall are still the best to go. So I think the best way is to learn basic education on the internet, and then come to see a real concert as a real inspirational content.
And continuing on at MIDEM, I talked with Kevin Wortis from a New York-based company Girly Action about the importance of label services.
I think that the economic environment is really ripe for more artists to want to take advantage of label services as opposed to a proper record company. A record company now can really provide three things. One, branding, which is crucial. If an artist has an opportunity to sign to 4AD, that's really going to take them places that they could not do if they self-released with no curation. And that's what good, proper label branding does. And I think there's a lot of room for that and can be very successful for artists. The other thing that artists can really take advantage of from labels is them being a bank.
Yeah.
And the last one is the services that are within a label company. So if you've got artists that do not need the branding or can't get it and have the money on their own, if they bet on themselves, they're going to make 5, 6, 7 times the money, have all the control. And this is particularly effective if the artist gets a lot of syncs.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, because that's where the real money is. And they're no longer beholden to a label. So we see a lot of people coming off of major label deals and checking in and seeing whether this is something they want to do. And some of them don't want to do it when they see what the price tag is.
Yeah, of course.
Some of them dive right in and make a lot of money.
Right. So yeah, it's kind of, you know, the artists have to take the bet upon themselves at this point rather than the label having to take the bet upon the artist.
Absolutely. Yes.
Talking about label services, there's so much stuff that goes into it in terms of coordinating. You know, we're talking about the fact that, you know, some of your staff, of course, delegated to specific functions within the label services division. So how do you decide as a company what you're going to do in-house and what you're going to outsource?
Okay. I joined Girly Action 2 years ago, and they're an 18-year-old PR firm. So the engine that drives Girly Action and the experience that informs everything what we do is PR and marketing. And we've got 4 teams that really just hammer out press. And in the U.S., as opposed to, say, the U.K., that means print media, dailies, TV, online, all of it. We've also now got a fairly robust management division. And so those things are in place. I came in and brought in really the hub of what we do is project management. And we've grown, and our first step in terms of growth was bringing in digital marketing and social media. And there's a lot of demand for that. And that is really where an artist can either maintain and communicate with fans or build a fan base. And increasingly, and there's going to be a lot of talk about this at Meetup this year, where they can coalesce everything that's happening with PR, everything that's happening with radio, and monetize it vis-a-vis direct-to-fan initiatives,
yeah,
crowdsourcing, if that's something that they're comfortable with. Not every artist is. And we can tie it all together, and we can sort of traffic control it and run it. Without a robust social media platform, none of that could work.
How do you manage the expectations of the fans towards... you know, sometimes, you know, we've seen like there's some backlashes on certain decisions or the fans asking questions about how the money is being used exactly. And how do you face those problems in a way that makes it like good for everyone?
Total transparency.
Yeah.
To the extent that the artist is comfortable with it. But it, all the messaging has to be authentic. All of it has to be true. There's no room for bullshitting in this new arena. There's no, you anything that is has a whiff of falsehood or pretense is so abundantly obvious now.
Yeah.
And we really encourage our clients to be not only truthful, but to embrace the fact that their fans love them for that. They want to be as the whole sense of mystique of an artist where, you know, we are the audience and we're down here and you are the artist who we adore, you're up here. That's kind of gone at this point now. And they want to be able to speak as directly as possible to the artist in total transparency. So in the event that there's backlash, and we've seen it, it's really taken care of with dialogue and discussion. And that doesn't mean that the artist ultimately convinces their fan base that what they did was right, but they are convincing in their heartfelt feelings on it,
yeah,
and their willingness to discuss. And so any singular issue, and with Amanda Palmer, we saw this with the question of whether or not she was paying her musicians, which was something that really sort of spiraled out of control and the message got a little bit lost. But she dealt with it beautifully by opening up the discussion. She was unafraid of people's opinions, and she said, listen, this is great. Let's talk this through. And at this point, it's a footnote.
Right? So how do you work on releases that don't have the same amount of publicity as Amanda Palmer's? Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with maybe a campaign that had a little bit of a harder time to get started and to get going?
Everything's got scale. I mean, the Amanda Palmer one blew up. And we certainly didn't go in thinking that we were going to gross $1 million. There are smaller ones. We did a Kickstarter campaign for an artist called Cody Chestnut. In the rest of the world, he was released on One Little Indian, which is a great label, and he's got a history with it. His pedigree, his legacy in the U.S. is self-releasing, but he needed some funds to do it. And he wanted to bring us in full service. He simply didn't have the cash flow for it. So we presented him with a Kickstarter campaign, and we came up with a figure that he needed, which was $20,000, and put together a set of of packages and bundles that we thought his fans would like.
Yeah.
And rolled it out, and we made it. It didn't blow the door off that goal. I can't recall where we ended, but it was just positive, just over 20,000, and it was a total success in terms of what we set out to do.
Yeah.
And that was very effective. And what that did was it's effectively pre-sale. So it's not that he didn't feel like he could afford it at the end of the day. It was just simply a cash flow issue.
Yeah.
So we set up a pre-sale. We used the Kickstarter platform to do that. And the money came in. That took care of some of the expenses that he had to self-release. And he's off to the races on his first U.S. tour.
And in a segue to Kevin's interview, here's my chat with the CEO of Pledge Music, Benji Rogers, explaining how the company works.
Sure. The concept of Pledge was that there was a lot of crowdfunding companies in the space. And there was a few when we launched it. And we really wanted to go in a different direction, more direct to fan direction, I guess it would be. And the concept really was that rather than say, fund my album and then I'll go make it, you would position it more as pledge here to be a part of the release of my new album. And from day one, you get access to a special part of the site that would have on it rough mixes, live tracks, demos, video blogs. And the reward for pledging is that you unlock this layer of, fan engagement. And that you could pledge in multiple different ways, and that a part of the profits could be given to a charity of the artist's choice. So what we saw was that whereas a crowdfunding campaign would last 30 or 60 days and then end, ours would continue from launch through till release of the record. And that meant that there was a lot more, the artist would do better financially.
Yeah.
The fans would engage throughout the process, and someone would show up and give money to a charity, which is... can't be bad.
It's cool, yeah, and it's cool to have the idea of it being a process rather than it being just a fixed deadline and then after that just being closed off.
The fixed deadline was always strange to me. Like you want to have some sort of gamification element. You want it to be like, and when we hit 50%, 70%, 75%, 99%, something happens. But what we would do is unlock more layers of access rather than just say like, because fundamentally, do music fans want to fund music, or do they want to see behind the scenes stuff? Do they want to hear stuff before everybody else? And we built the means to deliver the digital content. I hate that word. Deliver the digital music to the fans, and we help the artists get fulfill the physical stuff.
Yeah.
And really, what I viewed it was that we wanted to be the thinnest layer between fan and artist.
Yeah.
So the artist is comfortable, and some of the social technology we built means that when the artist does a pledges only update, which we call pledges only updates, it emails the fan directly. It auto feeds the artist's Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
But if I'm a fan and I've pledged, that same update will feed my Facebook and Twitter.
Oh,
so
great.
Each fan becomes like a sharing layer. So if you were just to run a 30 or 60 day campaign, that's not enough time to activate your entire fan base.
Yeah.
So our campaigns will run 3, 4, 5, 6 months, even sometimes a year. And as long as the artist delivers incredible music, videos, experiences, doesn't get boring. Crowdfunding's brilliance lies in proof of concept.
Yeah.
If enough people want this watch, I'll build it. But music has a very different dynamic. And so when I look at traditional crowdfunding campaigns that go out, they're often, the price points aren't thought through very carefully. We vet those projects. We help them get the campaign to where it's going to succeed, because my whole thing is that I don't want to have thousands and thousands of bands, you know, succeeding to this level. I want to have bands who have a better shot. And it's, you know, I never learned music business marketing when I was a musician. I could barely figure out how to tie my shoelaces. So I needed a team to help me. And we've assembled a team of people who've run thousands of these campaigns now, who go, you can't offer a signed CD and baked cookies for $10, because if you have to send that to Japan, you've lost money, which means that you're not going to be able to deliver your record, which means that there's, you know, it's a threat all the time.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, when we're working with the larger bands, you know, a band like, you know, we did the Ben Folds Five, you know, that was our first US top 10 album. You know, we were talking, you know, tens of thousands of sales, and it was a logistical thing, you know. There was a big piece to that, and getting CDs into boxes was a challenge for them.
Yeah.
And they did it, and it's, you know, it was a success. But I think that we got to look at these things as how they can fit into the music industry and not be just a standalone, you fund it and then it goes away, because there's a consequence to that. This is going to become a normal way in which albums are released.
Yeah.
And we're building ourselves into the fabric of a lot of, not just labels, but managers. And, you know, managers have used this 3, 4, and 5 times now.
Yeah.
So it's becoming normal. And when it becomes a normal part of the process, the fans win, because it involves maximum creativity to deliver these things. So the artists are getting to be creative, not just in the way that they make music, but a marketing team now has this tool that gives them not just 6 weeks to work, but 4 or 5 months. You can roll out the greatest marketing campaign on earth, and it pays for itself.
Yeah.
What's not to win there, you know? So, yeah, my goal is that this becomes a normal part of the conversation. The second the band walks in the studio, when they're being an artist, not just a salesman, when they're still an artist, is when the campaign goes live.
Yeah.
And it ends when it delivers to the stores.
Yeah.
That's my goal.
And also, this goes hand in hand with the rise of a label services company.
Yeah.
Which is really great for you guys, because, of course, you know, label services company, which are not traditional labels, that just help the artists deliver on their product and help them in their path. And, of course, you guys become a part of the story in that.
Yeah, it's been a phenomenal success working with label services companies, because what it's allowed our artists to do is come to the table with fully fledged finished product. And normally what would happen is, when they would crowdfund it, they would then have to take it to label services and start again.
Yeah.
What the partnerships we're making with label services companies mean that we can launch these campaigns, and the label services come in or are part of it from the word go. So your marketing doesn't begin when they pick it up. It's already started.
Yeah.
And so if you look at it from a label or a label services company's perspective, if we've already pre-sold a couple thousand records for the artists using the site, their job is made infinitely easier. They can go to radio and say, look at what's already happened. But I think that this will become the way in which music is released.
Yeah.
Fans will expect it, and they should, you know, because it's possible.
Yeah.
And streaming services took up a large portion of DMT's 2013 coverage. So here are a couple of interesting points made by the CEO of Deezer, Axel Dauchet. And Deezer is it's been relatively open on their API front as well. How what's your take on third-party developers accessing the API of Deezer or using some of the information that comes from Deezer for applications?
It's crucial. You know, we decided to focus all our innovation and on R&D to the core service, which is provide the best music service. And so opening the API is really externalizing all the innovation worldwide.
Yeah.
For the past 20 years, the music has been very difficult to deal with for any kind of developers, country per country. It was very complex, and finally those API allow to liberate, to unleash all the innovation worldwide. Whether you are a small developer or a car manufacturer, to seamless access to 20 million tracks in 200 countries, it was a dream
Yeah.
In the past, you know, it's reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And then talking about Deezer, you know, of course, a huge round of funding last year, you know, big expansion plans internationally. And a lot of people, of course, are, you know, talking about the US and the car, connected cars. But what's your vision for these types of services like connected cars and things that maybe are a little bit more behind the curve in other countries? But how do you see them develop in Europe and in other developing countries?
So I think we made that choice of being, of trying to be global.
Yeah.
It was a hard choice. I mean, it was a choice with a lot of corresponding investment.
Sure.
We did it not only to catch the emerging market growth. Of course, for that, you know, yesterday the market is very concentrated in six markets. Now, yeah. Brazil, Turkey, Indonesia will become contributing for the good sake of everybody.
Yeah.
It's also because we believe that every, even tiny markets, it's at the same time a source of creation. And if you give access to those artists to the worldwide market,
yeah,
finally you are changing the charts and the consumption pattern, even in the existing big countries. Because so far, what you're listening in France, in the US, is mainly driven by the distribution structure, not by the creation and its match with the audience. So being global was a way for us to really break down the barrier for every creator to have access to the audience he deserves.
How do you deal with the challenge that is, of course, the licensing side of music? Because with the international expansion comes having to deal with the collection societies in each territory, with different publishers, different partners. And of course, with so many territories, it becomes very difficult to have people on the ground on each territory. So how do you categorize different territories or manage to create an ecosystem where all those territories can be managed effectively, I guess?
There is a huge complexity. And so we spend a lot of nights to solve all those issues one by one. But that's, you know, when I'm in bad shape, I'm tired. When I'm in good shape, I'm saying, okay, I'm building an entry barrier to the next one.
So, absolutely, absolutely. You must be in a pretty unique position as well, because once you do get to the number of countries that you hope to get to, you know, you're going to be one of the companies with the most data on rights as well, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure we are yet there in terms of understanding of the data.
Yeah.
But we made some partnership with universities about trying to find something, of course, some algorithm to identify the emerging tracks. But also, which one I love, how to measure the transfer of an artist from a country to another.
Yes.
And this virality, this geographic movement of a track of an artist, we learn a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of on-demand streaming versus or with together with radio, how do you see those two coexisting? Can the, you know, and the curation of, for example, you know, an automatic channel based on, you know, a certain artist versus a purely on-demand offering?
I think two kind of questions. And about the curation, we are very invested in curation. We have a 40 editorial head worldwide covering all the main cultural area. And on those people, every week are listening to 250 new albums and select the best of the best. So we think it's crucial to re-engage the people with music as the non-algorithm-based recommendation. You know?
Sure.
Algorithm-based recommendation puts you in clusters. Editorial recommendation open your musical scope.
Yeah.
So it's important for us. I don't think radio and smart radios are doing that job. When you're on Pandora and you select a channel, even very customized, you will hear music, you will go through music you don't know, which is not discovery.
Yeah.
Discovery is when you make an active things. So we consider that not solving that issue. Second of all, there is a good a complementarity between on-demand and radio, because sometimes you need your music, sometimes you need some music.
Yeah.
So every user will switch from one to each other. However, I do consider that the Pandora model is specific to the US.
Absolutely.
We'll leave it open to the other service.
Sure. And final question, talking about how Deezer really broke into France through its partnerships with some of the mobile carriers, how are you planning to take that a similar strategy abroad, and is it very difficult to broker deals with the mobile carriers?
It's absolutely crucial for us. We are balancing a direct recruitment, leveraging Facebook and marketing investments with indirect recruitment through partners and specifically to carriers.
Yeah.
And the only thing, we need the carriers to be independent from Facebook and the Facebook to be independent from carriers. So we are trying to find the right balance between both. There is an incredible momentum for synergy with carriers.
Yeah.
We already signed a carriers deal in 25 countries. Including groups like telco groups like Orange, Dutch Telecom, Telenor, Millicom, Belgacom. You know, we really succeed in replicating those deals.
Yeah.
But the hardest part starts when you sign the deal.
Yeah.
Because there is a huge difference between making the deal and making a success from the deal. So we learn how to train the sales force, to work on the sales force commission structure to make sure that this deal will become a real success behind.
And as the last extract for today's show from my Medium coverage, here's my interview with Chris Wilsey from Bandpage, talking about how the company changed course following the introduction of the Facebook timeline and its plans for the rest of 2013, which actually panned out pretty well considering that the company announced data deals with the likes of Vivo and Xbox Music, amongst others.
In our particular case, an API allowed us to get into the market. So in this case, it was a Facebook API that we built the Bandpage application as a Facebook app. And at that time, there was no easy way or elegant way for a band to market themselves on Facebook. So 3 years ago, they were still pointing to MySpace, even though the fans had all, for the most part, left.
Yeah.
In that instance, we, you know, our founders did a beautiful job on executing a really good app, and so we just had a rocket ride of a takeoff. And
yeah.
So on our second anniversary at South by Southwest, we I think announced that it was maybe 175,000 bands,
yeah.
And then I guess no, that was our first year. Sorry, our second year, we announced 500,000 bands. And so a real rocket ride. One of the things we talked about in the panel, and there was a lot of interest about Bandpage because of the vulnerability.
Yeah.
At the same time, in developing to a single platform,
yeah.
It was sort of like a devil's bargain, I suppose, you know, where we had a tremendous opportunity and when we grew accordingly, and it afforded us an amazing amount of scale in a short amount of time. And part of that was identifying a real need, executing well, and on a huge platform.
Yeah.
But when Facebook changed directions and ushered in the timeline, ostensibly to improve the site in terms of engagement and,
yeah.
and posting, creating the ticker and being able to create many, many new types of advertising revenue, all kinds of reasons why they made that change, developers like us took a back seat.
Sure.
And so for us, what that meant was a big hit to the traffic. You know,
yeah.
We're still on Facebook. We're still a top 10 music app on Facebook, but the traffic levels are significantly reduced.
Yeah.
And so we talked on the panel about, dependencies, how to control and minimize risk, how companies work together, what are some optimal arrangements, that kind of thing. I think to do it again, would we do it any different? I honestly don't think we would do it any different. It would have been better if we had been ready to roll out our next sets of tools
right away, yeah.
Because we were, frankly, well down the path of developing our own APIs so that we could get the band page into other platforms,
sure,
and share the band page across the web and mobile. But the timeline shift essentially caught us before we were ready.
Yeah.
It takes a while to develop these things, and we really were committed to quality, the same quality for the bands that we serve that we had on Facebook, which frankly, quality, I think, is what allowed us to be so successful there.
Yeah.
We had the most elegant app, and that's why Beyonce and Kanye West and a bunch of top artists have used Bandpage. We wanted to have that same set of tools. So the same, I guess, vulnerability that, you know, that hurt us when the timeline came out is the API is also what is saving Bandpage.
Yeah,
and so when
sure.
we think about where we're headed, it is an API-driven strategy.
And moving on from Cannes in January to Austin in March, DMT did a lot of work at South by Southwest, and we start this short summary with a segment recorded with Vicky Norman, the president of North America at 7 Digital.
And of course, it's not just a question of getting, you know, the catalog that you already have to those markets. It's also a question of licensing their catalog for your service. So that's where it really starts to get tricky, because I've had some dealings with, you know, having to deal with songwriters from Mexico and having to call their collection society, and it was pretty hard to do. So do you guys have people on the ground that do that?
Well, we're somewhat masochists in this, because it's so difficult, because in each territory, every time you want to expand internationally, you have the labels, you have the publishers, there's usually some sort of collection society representing the publishers, so you have to do direct deals with all of them.
Yeah.
And then, in addition to that, there's usually really important market forces at play. So, is it carriers? Is it, you know, who are the gating items? What kind of devices do people use? Do they have connectivity in their homes, or is it in the workplace? What, you know, and if you're trying to license a la carte downloads, but the market, the price of a download is equal to dinner for a family of four for a week, then it doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
So we have to look at all of those factors and figure out what the right model is, when the time is right to go into it, and ways to have enough local connections on the ground to get the right catalog, the locally relevant catalog, and build the relationships.
One of the big things for the company has been the API. You know, you operate mostly a lot on a B2B basis with company using the API to offer your catalog out. You know, the numbers are great. You know, 137% increase year over year, and 13.5k API requests per minute, which is great. And so, you know, there are two sides to this. On the one side, you have the big partners like the Pure of this world, and you know, Samsung and all that side, and then you have the smaller companies. So on the smaller company side, how do you, of course, it takes a lot of legwork to do these deals and to get them together, but it's, do you find that there's a great response from them? Because of course, otherwise, it's almost impossible for them to get the catalog that they need.
It is, and the big companies are great because they have distribution, they have growth, they have reach into every home across the world. But the startups and the small companies are really significant to us because they use the API in ways that the big companies will never do, because they're very creative, very innovative, and they will help. The API is open,
yeah.
So they'll help expand all of the functionality for everyone. But the other thing that's really important about the smaller companies and the startups is that they need an active pool of music to work with. And so, but it's a chicken and the egg. Because they have an idea and they want to build something,
yeah.
But they don't know what rights they need, and they can't get the rights, they can't get a catalog unless they have cleared the rights. So we've done a couple of things, like we created this prototype package that gives developers 3 months to do whatever they want with our catalog. It's for prototype and beta only, and that gives them an active pool of music and live music to be able to demonstrate what they're trying to build. And sometimes that's really, you know, like they have to have access to the music in order to really get across the power of their application. You know,
yeah.
PowerPoint or a pitch just doesn't quite do it.
No, of course. And one of the challenges I think that is going to be faced by any service that works in music at this point is going to be one of cross compatibility. I mean, of course, nobody's even thinking about this right now. So, you know, there's no way that you can port things from Spotify to Deezer to RDO. But, you know, playlist portability and metadata portability cross compatibility of links as well. Like, you know, if a friend of yours is not on the same service, are a big issue. Do you think there's a chance that at some point in the future there's going to be some resolution to that?
Well, I think there's. I would like to think that there would be. But I think there's a couple of issues that are really big underlying issues in our industry. One is there's no single identifier for a song. So, you know, this seems really strange because, you know, each computer has a unique identifier, but we can't seem to come up with that for music. That's difficult. But there are some companies trying to solve that problem, and we're one of them in there. And you know, services that are gated off strictly by a subscription, they have, you know, of course they don't want their playlists to be portable to another service that's gated off by subscription because those things are mutually exclusive. But again, we see a value in focusing on the user and focusing on the user experience. And what we know about music lovers is that they want a variety of sources. They want programmed music. They want their own, they want to own their own collection, and maybe they want to subscribe to something. And we see value in trying to keep the music that they love relevant across all of those types of services.
And we continue the South by Southwest coverage with the president of CD Baby, Brian Felsen.
You know, but CD Baby has been one of the sort of pioneering platforms for distribution of music, and you work in the physical and the digital market. Of course, a lot of people just think of you as a digital distribution service, but you also have a strong and healthy CD distribution service.
Yeah.
So how has that been evolving in the past two or three years in the balance between the physical and the digital?
It's been evolving in interesting ways because the physical CDs had been in decline for a while. So we have been doing all kinds of things, such as sending to more streaming services, doing deals with different territories, with cell phone carriers, sync licensing things, getting people paid for YouTube, foreign royalty collection. But the strangest thing happened is that over the last year, year over year, our physical sales are up 25%. So that's something we never expected. And looking back on it, we can tell it's because of our deal with Alliance and because of our better algorithms and relationships with Amazon and people like Best Buy and Target and things like that. But we just did not expect that kind of a turnaround.
Of course. You know, now there's hundreds of different digital services. There's so many. And it's kind of a hard choice to understand really who you have to concentrate on. You know, a company's time is not limitless, so you have to dedicate resources to the services that you think are going to be, you know, bringing money to your artist, of course. So what's your take on that? And, you know, and also internationally, how do you see services that maybe not be on the radar for us in the US or in the UK?
Well, there's always a balance, right? I mean, I go to festivals all over the world, just got back from Midem, and just trying to find new territories and new services that have an interesting model that can make money for their artists. Some of them, which I know will not be in existence 6 months from now, I just won't do the deal. And some, you know, other companies will, and then they'll spend their resources and then the company will go under. Or some of it, the artists just make so little money, it's almost detrimental. But we found a way just from looking at companies overseas and people like Bloom and Yandex and all these new markets and things, that we've been able to grow the streaming services in the foreign territories but still have our download sales and our physical sales go up. So our point is to not cannibalize any of the more traditional venues.
Yeah, sure. And you know, the backend side of a service like yours must have become really difficult to deal with in the last four or five years with all the streaming services coming into play. And of course, a service that has hundreds of thousands of, you know, of tracks, it's even more difficult. So how did you build that part of it up? And was it tricky to find the right way to really account for and report on the streaming royalties?
Yes. The short is that we screwed it up royally. We were going along merrily. We had a couple hundred thousand artists, and what happened was we were growing faster than we had projected, and then we did a deal with Spotify. And Spotify literally broke our accounting. It was like suddenly we had millions of lines of incoming stream going to four decimal places after the penny, and it was like, it was total, like, all-nighters, all weekends, just trying to be able to account for it all. And, you know, now we have it. We have probably the most robust accounting system in the industry. We handle almost 5 million tracks and millions of lines of streaming data, which we can display every single one for our dozens of partners. But, man, it wasn't easy.
Looking at services like iTunes, of course, it's still got a huge, influence in the sales and in the industry in general. How's your relationship with iTunes? And I myself used to work at a label, and it was very, very difficult to actually get hold of them and talk to them and get them to do anything. So has that improved on the customer service side?
Our relationship with iTunes is unparalleled. In fact, we're going to dinner tonight again. I'm in Cupertino all the time. The thing is, not only do we give them the largest chunk of their catalog, but we also have the cleanest data and metadata, which makes them very happy. So we have a direct connect relationship, which gets us our artists live within 48 or even 24 hours. So they audit us, and they keep saying, okay, are there any tickets? Are there any problems with the audio, problems with the metadata? But we're number one among our peers in terms of the quality of our delivery.
That's great. And do you feel like they're being relatively open when it comes to featuring artists as well?
iTunes is going to feature who they're going to feature. So we can push artists to them. But the fact of it is that if you win America's Got Talent or something like that, you're going to be featured. And for us, if there's an interesting story of an artist touring or that has a big bump in sales velocity or something, they'll feature it. And we let them know who we think is really good and who's up and coming, but they're going to do what they're going to do. They've got such a huge platform, and it's, we can't just dictate who they're going to push.
Of course. And do you feel like streaming services as well? I know quite a few of them have, the aspiration to demonstrate that they can break artists as well. So do you find that they maybe they're really looking for stories and looking for artists that they want to champion and push?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's ones like even Rhapsody, which was the first, is looking with their deal with Metro PCS to push musics and genres for that demographic. So they're very interested in playlists, and Beats is coming out with their new service, and they're talking about curation. So they are interested, but not just breaking artists. These streaming services have another challenge, which is simply to break even. So it'll be very interesting to see how that all works out in the next couple of years.
Sure.
Following on from Brian, here's my chat with Theda Sandiford, the VP of Digital Marketing at Universal Republic Records. And here we chat mostly about mobile.
And taking a look at the landscape for digital marketing, of course, we're seeing some huge numbers from some companies. Like, for example, Pandora was talking about how 75% of the listening hours are on mobile, and their mobile advertising unit is doing surprisingly really well. RDO has revealed, I think 80% of the listeners are on mobile. And so how does the marketing play stand for labels when it comes to mobile? Because, of course, 3 or 4 years ago, everybody was talking about artist-specific apps, and they still are, in a sense, but we're not seeing as big of a push or as many releases anymore as I would have thought. So how is that working?
Okay, well, one thing is I personally hate artist vanity apps.
Yeah.
When that was the trend was, we're going to offer something exclusive through this mobile app. Well, they never offered anything exclusive through the mobile app. It was always more of what you can get on Twitter or Facebook or on the artist's webpage.
Yeah.
So I don't think the experience of that exclusive sort of mobile thing, the only thing you get for it really is the push messaging on the mobile phone. And honestly, that's not enough of a reason to have a mobile app. The other reason why artist vanity mobile apps are a mistake is that you have to market and sell that app. Once it's in the app store, if you're not in the top 20 or the second page of people looking through free apps, no one's finding you and they're not looking for you. And if you're not ranked there, you don't really exist. And the core business of a record company is to sell music. So the same amount of energy, effort, and marketing has to go into selling these apps, which you then can't sell music to.
Yeah.
As you would sell a music product. So either download, stream, or some sort of view you're driving on YouTube.
Yeah.
So it right now, it just doesn't scale, and it doesn't make sense. I've switched every artist that says I want a mobile app. I said, great, go build it on yourself. Go ahead, and here's my recommendation how you would want to market it. But we're gonna make our money doing what we know that we could sell. So all our artist sites are now mobile optimized sites. So if I'm more people are searching on the phone looking for something, and all the data I see shows that the mobile search and people coming to the artist websites from their phones is greater than ever before. At least averaging anywhere from 30 to 70%, depending on the artist and the genre, are coming from mobile. They're not sitting there doing
it. No flash.
No flash, and limited on HTML5. Yeah. But really, you know, building off a platform that has responsive design that's really looking at. Looking at how people across the board, less time spending testing various browsers, more time focused on people's consumption patterns on mobiles and tablets.
Of course. So how do you see the role of radio, traditional radio, changing in a campaign to break an act? I mean, in the UK, I was in a few panels where you know, people kept talking about how radio is something that shouldn't be important anymore in theory because of the internet, but it's actually the most important thing.
One radio station.
Yeah, and it's still incredibly important to break an artist. Yeah, how's the situation in the US?
Well, I mean, we have multiple formats and tens of thousands of radio stations. So, you know, a band like of Monsters and Men, which broke out of South by Southwest last year, started in one format, and is that same song, Little Talks, is just now crossing to top 40 a year later.
Yeah.
So I think I can only speak from the United States perspective because of the proliferation of all the different genres of radio stations and the time it takes from one song to move from one genre, from AAA to alternative to rock to top 40. That can take 18 months to pass through that entire cycle.
Wow.
I've noticed with apps like iHeartRadio, Last.fm for CBS, and I believe, I'll just talk about those two because those are probably the two biggest change, CBS and Clear Channel.
Sure.
They are doing interesting things with their mobile radio apps. They have developing artist programs.
Yeah.
They're doing things within their apps where they will play music that they haven't even added to the radio station yet to warm it up, to see what data they get back. Are people requesting it? If they play that song after another song and through the mobile app, what is the reaction? Are people skipping? Are they staying around longer? And they're using this data so that they then take to their terrestrial radio stations and kind of inform some of the programming decision process.
That's awesome. It's almost like A/B testing. Like that.
I think so. Yeah, and it's really awesome that they're getting there and are starting to do that. So they also recognize that their local radio station is a local resource,
yep.
Whereas since so much of the programming is on a nationalized basis, national chains, syndicated programs coming in, that the local flavor of that radio station is really reflected on the website.
Yeah,
so you see that there's content and effort to create content when the artist is up at the radio station that can live on in an archive type environment on the local radio station website. So all that's very encouraging.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Now, one thing I don't think most radio stations do very well, terrestrial stations, is they don't do social well. They're a traditional broadcast medium. I'm talking at you.
Yeah.
And social is a conversation. And so when you look on their Facebook pages, you notice that there's very low talks about, which is an indication that there's low engagement on the page.
Yeah.
And that's something they could be doing a lot better job. It's not just, I shot this great video and interview with the artist when they were up at the station. It's, what other content can you build around that piece of media that is more engaging as a conversation with the audience. And when radio stations learn how to do that, they will definitely be in a much better position socially competing against Pandora's and Spotify's and RDO's and Deezer's and all of those type of applications.
Yeah, of course.
And Cristelia Garcia from the George Washington Law School talks about termination rights in the U.S.
One of the first things that, you know, you mentioned when we started emailing was the issue of termination rights and how that is evolving in the United States, of course, because that's where a lot of the conversations are taking place. So just tell me a bit about, you know, generally about what's the situation in the States in regards to that.
Sure. Termination rights are a real hot topic right now, primarily because this is the first time, January 2013, that artists are really able to make a claim for those rights. Termination rights are also a big deal because of the potential consequences they have for record labels and publishing companies, and for the possible gains that they present for artists. So termination rights came about with the 1976 Copyright Act, and basically it was Congress's way of recognizing a disparity between the bargaining power in artists and intermediaries like record labels and music publishers. In other words, the Beach Boys didn't know that they were going to be the Beach Boys, and so they may have taken deal on less favorable terms. This termination rights kind of gives them a second bite at the apple, if you will, by allowing them to, 35 years later, come back and say, okay, we want our rights back, and they can renegotiate deals with better terms.
Yeah.
They can take their masters and do with them what they will. They can sell them on their own. So this is kind of what the thing is. And, you know, the consequences of that for record labels, although as consumers we often focus on new and upcoming artists and new releases, catalog, which is what we call like everything that's not a new release, is really, for most major record labels, upwards of 70% of their revenues. So this is a big deal if they were to start losing out on these things. It's not as simple as all that, and I'm sure there's lots of tricks on both sides for, you know, attorneys to prevent this from happening, but that's kind of the gist of termination rights. And the reason they're becoming a big deal now, like I said, is because this is the first time that we're actually being able to see people claiming them, and it remains to be seen how successful they are, and if they are successful, what that will mean for contracts going forward.
Absolutely. And looking at, for example, the issue of like the length of copyright, for example, is something that every time we come up to the deadline of a copyright, it seems like it's getting extended. So what's the deal on the legislative side of things for termination rights? And have there been proposals, of course, probably lobbied by, you know, record labels to extend what was the term deemed from that?
So the statutory time on termination rights, as I mentioned, is 35 years. That is currently not up for debate, and there aren't any bills that I know of to extend that time. Instead, what intermediary copyright holders like record labels are going to do is fight termination rights on a couple of other legal bases. One that's probably the most popular that's sort of started now is work for hire, which is just legalese for an employee-employer relationship.
Yeah.
The termination rights clause in the Copyright Act excludes work for hire from being able to exercise termination rights. So if a copyright holder like a record label can show that in fact the musician was an employee in a work for hire situation, they are excluded from termination rights and they won't be able to exercise them. So if they can pull that off and make that argument, that would be convenient. Of course, the trick is most musicians aren't employees, right? They're, if anything, more like contractors or freelance workers. They generally don't enjoy a salary or health benefits. So it'll be a little tricky to prove this. Not that record labels haven't tried by actually putting work for hire language in the contracts. But the fortunate thing for some artists is that the way that the termination rights section of the statute is drafted says that even if you claim it's a work for hire, the courts can disregard that if they don't think it really is. So, remains to be seen. We really need a test case. We need someone to press for their rights and be sued by the labels, or have the labels resist and then be sued, so that we can see what courts are actually going to do with it. It's so early yet, we don't have that. And, right now we do have people like the Eagles and the Beach Boys, for example, who have filed for their termination rights, but we have labels who've not responded, just radio silence. So we're all kind of, the copyright nerds among us are excited to see if there will be a response. And if not, will they just peacefully let it go? Will they resist? And then will there be lawsuits? Unfortunately, I think we need a test case to know what to do with these.
This year on DMT, we covered Songza a lot, although the company still has quite a bit of ground to cover in order to catch up to competitors like Pandora. And here is my chat with one of the founders, Eric Davish.
So it's actually, Songza is very new to most people, but we've been a company since 2006. We started as a digital download store called Amy Street, where we sold MP3s dynamically priced. So based on, you know, when you came to Amy Street, every song started for free and increased in price the more that it was purchased. There was a social element, there was a gaming element.
Yeah.
And we had a nice little user base, very engaged people, big music fans, a lot of independent artists getting their music discovered. And we had a nice platform. But in our own personal lives, we were using streaming to discover music, and we found that it was really frictionless, easy way to share music, easy way to listen and sample. So we started experimenting with Songza. And so for a while, we were doing both Amy Street and Songza. When we started Songza originally, it was a much different product. We tried many different things with Songza, and ultimately, we saw a much bigger future with the streaming space and with Songza, and so decided that we wanted to do that full time. So we sold the Amy Street brand to Amazon, who's an investor in us since 2007, and concentrated on Songza full time starting in 2010. And the Songza product evolved several times throughout those, from 2010 to 2012, starting as a social radio service in which we would curate playlists and encourage people to add songs with a similar theme. But we found that it was hard to regulate the songs that the community would add to a thematic playlist, and the theme would get lost. So we started curating, we closed off playlists and started curating a bit more, more thematic playlists, and we eventually started doing thematic playlists that were based on lifestyle. So, you know, in our own lives, we were noticing that we listen to music while we're doing other things. We're listening to music while we're working out, while we're working. And it served as a way to enhance our mood, to make what we were doing go by faster, to be better, to be more enjoyable. So we decided to build out an expertly curated playlist library based on genres, moods, decades, activities, cultural events, and this thing called Record Store Clerk. And we, in 2011, had come out with the first version of the Songza mobile application, which is pretty much our library of playlists that you could browse through. And so you could browse by activity to find workout playlists, and then browse through dozens of workout playlists to find the perfect one. Problem with that was that it was a little bit too difficult, a little too labor-intensive, a little too mental math-heavy. So that required thought, it required, work, it took, 30 seconds or so to find the perfect playlist, if not more. So we decided, after showing it to a lot of people, after, getting some really great feedback, that we wanted to shorten the process of getting you to the perfect playlist, and instead of making you search for it or find it yourself, we wanted to be able to deliver it to you. And in our own anecdotal experience, we were able to deliver people a perfect playlist when we showed it to them in person in about two steps. And so we aimed to simulate that experience with the concierge, and that's sort of how that came about. We debuted that about a year ago, first on the web, then on iPhone, Android, and on tablets for both of those platforms. And when we debuted our iPad app in June of last year, we got featured on the front page of the iTunes App Store, went to number one on their charts, downloaded, got 1.15 million installations on iOS platforms alone in a week. So, that was when people really started to pay attention to us, and that's when people really started to acknowledge our existence. It's great to hear when people, that people love Songza, but what we're so focused on improving the product always that, anyone who tells me that they love Songza, I will ask them, what can we do to make it better? What do you not like about Songza? It's part of our DNA is to, question all our assumptions that we've made, all the punches that we've had, all the, you know, all the features that we've got, all the potential features that we could make, you know, what can we do to make that even better? Because, you know, we're going to need to, you know, there's a lot, there's a long way for us to go. You'd be surprised, you know, people think that songs is perfect, but there's a lot that we can do to make songs better, and there's a lot that we have planned that's going to really, you know, really surprise and delight you as you continue to use the service. And so we want to make sure that we're always ahead of that, always innovating and always thinking creatively in that respect.
And as the final extract from my South by Southwest coverage, here's a chat with Katie McMahon from music recognition service SoundHound.
And with international expansion come, and you know, more and more stores being added to the App Store by Apple, and more and more countries, comes like a challenge in the tagging of the music as well. So how have you managed sort of the growth of the database and the ingestion of international catalog as well?
Yeah, and that's really important, because while you need to have the massive hits, it's important in regional markets to likewise make sure you have local databases. And we work across every platform of major labels, independents, and we have artists coming to us directly saying, please ingest my albums or my collection, because I know if fans are trying to SoundHound and you want to give them that result. Yeah. So it's a big part of our effort to continuously grow our database. Also, the other thing that we're heavily focused on is our live lyrics database, if you will, having songs, the lyrics, but making those live lyric eyes. So that's a SoundHound feature where literally if I ID a song, if I'm standing in the coffee shop, the song information comes, the beautiful graphic, but that song's lyrics are moving in sync with the song at the moment in time.
Yeah.
And that is just a reemergence of the love for lyrics.
Yeah, sure. And do you guys power that service yourself, or do you have a third?
We do. No, that's a wholly owned and created in-house technology from SoundHound Inc. So to be able to continually take songs and make sure that the lyrics aren't static, but they're live lyrics, that likewise is part of a growth internally in our back-end database that the team of engineers are set across.
And the same thing on the licensing side, right? You license the
right.
Tracks itself.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah, and you're talking about London and maps are a big thing as well for SoundHound. So you've recently partnered with Audio to offer sort of a mapping experience for your users that would allow them to work out what tracks have been played where.
Exactly.
And this is something that, you know, aside from just audio, is something that it really taps into the data that you collect on
Absolutely.
What's being tagged where and when. So what do you think is the evolutionary step in the use of this data? And do you think you can make the most of it as an individual company, or do you think you're going to open up something
yeah.
in order to get more companies to come in and make really amazing stuff with it?
Well, you're hitting on the topic of data and what SoundHound sits on in terms of how much information we know across music taste,
yeah.
what time, where, when, what people are using identification for. And that opens up a wealth, a treasure trove of insight.
Yeah.
Could it be very valuable to record labels to understand where do I put my A&R dollars? What artist is going to really break through?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, inside of SoundHound, we have, you know, the hottest chart and the most tweeted chart, but we also have something called SoundHound Discoveries, and
yeah.
that's one of our charts, which we do this thing where we're trying to weight how much a song gets radio played and discount that in order to bubble up songs that are, for some reason, really getting a response. Again, no one is holding a gun to someone's head to say, go ID this. But for some reason, someone's pulling out their device, capturing that song. It could be a song that's being played on an audio, on a TV commercial. It could be a song from the 80s that has a reemergence, and we can see that trend happen, right? So that's an example of where data is incredibly interesting.
Yeah.
But back to bubbling it up to the end user to really enjoy and dive into, but I should mention that on SoundHound Discoveries, we're already predicting who will win the Grammys in 2 years' time. You know,
wow.
3 years back, we saw Lady Antebellum bubble up. 2 years ago, we saw Mumford & Sons bubbling up. And it's almost this lag time that then suddenly, boom, the Grammys is right there.
Yeah.
But to the point of the maps feature, why this is so fun is we've always wanted to bring out exactly this experience where really it's music voyeurism.
Yeah.
Who's listening to what where? And all you need to do is tap on it, open up that map, zoom, 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 and drill down literally to this town in Austin. We can see what is getting ID'd right then and there.
Yeah.
It's really a fun, engaging. I can play it. I can listen to it. I can shrink the map, flip over to London, and see what's getting soundhounded there. And it's music voyeurism for anybody that wants to discover new music or just learn what's getting played in Sao Paulo. It can be a total random moment, mindless at times, or a real lean in of like, let me find some track that I otherwise never would have come across.
Yeah. And from Austin, Texas to Mannheim in Germany, I went to the Future Music Camp once again. I love the Pop Academy down there. And here's an extract with my chat with Ulysses Hupauf from the management company Odyssey Music Network.
So one of the things that we talked about on the show quite a bit is the evolving role of management and management becoming a hub for the artist, providing a lot of services that maybe labels are not willing or able to provide anymore. More also as certain things become more relevant, like social media and direct to fan and that kind of stuff. So how do you take that and how can you evolve as management to be able to serve all these things without going crazy, basically? Because it's a lot of things to take care of.
Well, I think that management completely changed in the last 10 years, from being the spokesperson for a band and the label will do the decision and delivers all the service to basically the center of making the decisions and sometimes, you know, even need to fund fundings for it and run campaigns and have a master plan there while no one else would develop one. So yeah. All of a sudden, I think management is in the role that they have to create artist careers, find the right people for it, and not rely on any of the others to do so, but do it yourself.
Yeah. And what do you think, another type of company that's sort of springing up in the last few years, which is taking an important role, especially as management has to offlay some of their responsibility as well, is labor relations services as well, which can manage anything from a pledge campaign to take on some of the sort of load of managers, for example. So do you think that's a useful tool for you, or would you rather it be more centralized?
Well, in one way, I think that's exactly what we offer. We have everything built around artist management, but then we offer label services to release records and market those records. We do that with other independent artists, which we don't represent in management. We do it for international labels, for GSA or for mainland Europe. We have a consulting unit where we have things like Pledge, while we just meet here. We represent Pledge, do a lot of work for Pledge, which helps our artists as well. We have a publishing unit, which works with Universal, which delivers a lot of the publishing assets to it. So we have a producer management side of things where we have access to studios and producers for it. So that's kind of exactly the system and idea what we're having.
Yeah, of course. And looking at the sort of German music scene, of course, if you look at the stats in Germany, physical is still very, very important. And so, but that's in a way a little bit problematic, especially if you have a campaign where you want to bring more independently and without the aids of major labels. So what are the tools here in Germany for an independent artist, for example, to distribute a physical record in an effective way so that they can still make money off it?
True. On one hand, very luckily, physical is very strong still in Germany. There's a great infrastructure on distribution and especially on shops to sell music. We have a good infrastructure of independent distribution companies. Major distribution companies also opened up more for indies to come in to do distribution for them. So the old saying that the major record label controls distribution, it's not true anymore. We see more and more that big independent artists go with independent distribution and are as successful, sometimes even more successful than they were when they were with majors. But they play a role. And the majors play a role there because the distribution systems they have are very, very strong and valid.
And also in Mannheim, in my first Top Gear style interview from a car, as I interview Peter Bergner about the latest developments in dashboard technology at BMW.
And so in terms of connectivity, how are you finding the experience of streaming? Because of course, one of the big worries that people have when you talk about streaming music in the car is the fact that you're not going to have connection all the time. So how is that side of it? How are you working on that?
Yeah. So we try to optimize it as best as we can. So obviously, if you have no internet connection at all, then you just can listen what you've downloaded before. Right now, this is TuneIn. So in TuneIn, we have a functionality called Time Shift. So we could simply skip back a title and listen to that title again. So if we have no reception, for example. If we use other applications like Pandora in the US or OPIO, in those radio-ish applications, we try to cache songs ahead. So even when you are in a bad in an area with poor reception, you still have access to your great music.
That's awesome. And so there's a little bit of caching as well involved, I guess, whilst the music is playing. So if you go through a tunnel, you still have those 10 seconds ahead that you can keep listening, and then it will catch up when it reconnects.
Yes, exactly. Even though tunnels are interesting, because tunnels are typically where you have the best reception, because people want to be able to make phone calls there. So yeah. In tunnels, you'll always have great reception while FM typically doesn't work.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, looking at how this field is evolving, of course, the biggest challenge that I hear from people that work in the car space is that cars are designed a long time ahead. And so, you know, the biggest problem that manufacturers have is that technology moves so quickly that the worry is that if you design a system, then it's going to be 4 years old by the time you take it to market. So how do you manage to avoid that?
Yep. So what we did is we created that generic interface called BMW Apps, which you find in the Connected Drive menu. And you can enable any application on the phone to connect to that interface. So like this, we can retrofit new functionality even to old cars. So for example, we launched this interface in Mini already in 2010, and the new applications which we just announced, like TuneIn Rhapsody, they work seamlessly also in those models.
Yeah, sure. And moving on from Mannheim to Washington, D.C., it was the turn of the World Creator Summit organized by CSAC. And in that respect, I gotta start with a segment recorded with French music legend and the new CSAC president, Jean-Michel Jarre.
You're a pioneer of electronic music. Of course, you use technology from the very early stages as a tool. And a lot of the conversation that I heard today from the creators is that technology has to be seen as a tool, and it can be a positive one, but you know, there is still a little bit of friction between the technology industry and the creative industries, at least as far as I've seen in the last couple of days. So how do you think that can be smoothed out?
Actually, I always, in my own career, I always had to fight against the system using new technology.
Yeah.
When I started as a musician as in electronic music, we're just considered a bunch of crazy guys doing crazy sounds on odd and weird instruments. Yeah. And actually, my first album, like Oxygen, has been refused and rejected by all record companies at that time. So I think I have a kind of experience of fighting and dealing with new technology.
Yeah.
And I can say that generation after generation, we always have two attitudes. One is to be scared. It's always happened. When television happened, the world of cinema said, "Okay, this is the end of it," and it was the reverse. When the recording industry started, all the publishers and the publishing world said, "This is the end of it." We had the monopoly of rights, and now it's the guys, I mean, manufacturing vinyls and records and so on and so forth, who are going to steal from us. And then it didn't really happen because, I mean, they had to adapt themselves to the new system. I think it's the same thing with internet. We have to find a way to deal with the new rule and with the new instruments. Actually, you have to. I think it's not very positive to try to oppose and to create an opposition between artists who could be a kind of victims and complaining. It's not what we are anyway. The world is not waiting of having. It's not the image of artists.
Sure.
And so we have to. okay, to backstage to discuss exactly what we want, and then conveying one clear and clear and precise message. And on the other hand, I mean, if you think about Google and YouTube, it has been created by young kids 15 years ago. Yeah. All these giants of the internet even didn't existed 15 years ago, and those kids suddenly who created that. I mean, they created a fantastic tool, but they had no idea that 15 years later they could be considered as devils. They may become devils, but they still have a chance, maybe. Yeah, yeah, sure. And this opportunity for us is to find a way. They need us, and we need them. But it's a matter of vocabulary, grammar, and communication, and education, and also we must also promote what we are talking about to the public opinion. Yeah. People in the street don't understand what we are talking about. It's our responsibility to make our message clear. And at the moment, I mean, people don't even know what CSAC is, PRS, ASCAP, all these acronyms are very abstract. So there is a big confusion. And obviously, and also, it's absolutely unfair and untrue to consider that manufacturer of electronic products would symbolize the future, and artists and creators would symbolize a kind of old-fashioned world with rich kids sat on their pots of gold. I think this has to be restored. We have been the outsiders as artists and creators, questioning and shaking the trees and questioning societies. We must restore this image and having an image more exciting, more glamorous that we always artists always had, and finding the appropriate economic system.
And it was a bit of a coup to get the US's Register of Copyrights Maria Palante on the show. I hadn't had any heavyweight politicians from Washington on the show as of yet, so let's hear what she had to say.
What is the role of the Copyright Office as part of the US government?
So the US Copyright Office is part of the Library of Congress, and we, since 1897, that era, first started in 1870 and then later officially incorporated in 1897, have been a key advisor to the U.S. Congress on copyright policy. We administer the registration and recordation systems of the United States. We administer other provisions of the law. And we have a public office that handles questions from the public. And we have an international team that supports our colleagues across the U.S. government.
Yeah. And you talked about taking a more sort of step-by-step approach to the review of copyright, because, of course, a full review done all at the same time could take years. As you mentioned, the last one took around 20 years. And so you talk about a holistic approach. And so what do you think are the key areas that require some look at?
So that's a great question. The key areas are areas Congress has been debating for a long time. So they're not brand new. It's not as though everybody woke up one day and said, we should look at the copyright law. So full public performance right for sound recordings, orphan work solutions, innovative enforcement mechanisms that may include a mix of legislation, private agreement, and best practices, for example, flexibility, making the law more accessible to people who have to navigate it, consumers, teenagers who are consumers, educators, people who really need guidance and who want to do the right thing, making sure that exclusive rights fit the way that works are made available to the public. Yeah. If works are increasingly being streamed, do we have provisions that reflect that, not only on the scope of the exclusive rights, but also on the enforcement side? And supporting robust licensing regimes. As we go forward into the digital age, licensing should be painless, invisible if possible, expedient, efficient, and everybody will be well served. Those are just a few.
Yeah, sure. And you talked about also, of course, the Copyright Office is a point of reference for your congressmen that can ask you questions that are both theirs and their constituents. So talk about some of the concerns that were expressed to you by the congressmen. What are, you know, maybe a couple of the more interesting stories or you know, concerns that you've taken into account when thinking about this review?
Well, yeah. So different congressional offices reach out to us on a range of questions. Some very big. What should the next great Copyright Act look like? Yeah. And then some very discreet. Here are issues I'm hearing about in my district, where I may have a university or I may have a tech company, where I have a lot of authors struggling. So. Yeah. We're very pleased by the level of interest and commitment by members who talk to us. Absolutely. They seem, in my view, to be very much aware that authors are having a difficult time making a living, that the internet has changed a lot, but that core principles of copyright must apply, yeah. That it's important to culture and to commerce. They ask about DRM, they ask about orphan works, they ask about fair use, they ask about licensing. I think there's not an area that they haven't asked us about. And then more philosophically, they ask questions like, why has the copyright debate become hostile? Yeah. How do we get back on track? How do we get respect back into the system, and how do we make it accessible to people who need it?
And from politics to music, here's a short segment recorded with African music star Angelique Kidjo.
That's the good and positive side of internet, where people, most of the people that didn't know my music before, can go on internet today and discover my work and discover where I am in the world playing, which is a good exposure, because before you need the radio, you need the TV. You still need radio and TV today, but internet make it easier access for people to go and find out information about an artist. If they want to come to a show, they can go online and find out who I am before they come to the show. And that is a good, very good part of it. But still, internet is a tool. We have to remember that it's a tool. Internet cannot replace people.
Yeah.
So if we all react and use internet in that mindset, we might come to an agreement where we use it as a tool of knowledge, a tool of entertainment, but savvy tools for everybody, savvy users, conscious users, because if we infringe on the right of other people, we cannot say that there is democracy. I mean, technology does not mean we're not respecting other people's work. And the moral value and the morality of it is something that we have to bring back into this discussion.
And as a final extract from my coverage at the World Creators Summit, here's my interview with Robert Ashcroft, the chief executive at PRS for Music. So last time we were talking about the Global Repertoire Database, there's been a lot of talk about that in the last couple of days, and people seem to be pretty excited about it, even if it is a European-driven initiative, the US is really starting to take notice of it. So what are your feelings about the GRD, and what do you think now is the right time to get this going?
Well, it started off being European, really, because it was the first territory in which we were doing pan-territorial licensing, and in a split copyright world, you know, you suddenly find that gets quite complicated. Already we're seeing global deals being done now. So it might have started in Europe, but it's really just a technical problem of being able to issue an accurate invoice for the works that are related to the sound recordings that have been streamed or downloaded or whatever. And the numbers involved are so large that the only way of calculating the correct amount of money to pay for the right owners is to automate the process. And you can't automate it unless you have an accurate database. Otherwise, you get unmatched usages. And the individual sums of money, particularly on streaming services or redownloads for cloud locker services, are so small that you can't afford then to put manual labor into expert matching. So you need an accurate database.
Yeah, and looking at the the world of data. You guys do an incredible job at cleaning up the data that you have in your database and making sure that it's accurate and you can pay out your members. In terms of how these different databases could coexist together into one unit, do you think are you optimistic about the chances of being able to find a compromise where everybody's happy with the end result?
Yes, I think that we've done a lot of study in the design process and looking at all the process flows and understanding who has the authoritative view of which version is correct in which territory. There's been an awful lot of study of that in partnership with Deloitte and the working group and all the various people who've contributed to it. And we're looking now to September to kick it all off.
Yeah, it's very exciting, absolutely. And looking at the way in which the GRD also brings people together at the same table, one conversation that I had today that was interesting was the fact that aside from being an amazing project in itself, which is absolutely needed to be done, it's also a place where both technology companies and rights holders and companies that work within the content industries are actually coming together at a table in a sort of solution-focused environment, and so they can get past some of the maybe the differences that there are between them anyway, and so make better friends in a way as well.
Well, that's a process. You know, people come into a forum like that with some of their prejudices and the attitudes that they bring to the table from a historical perspective, and then the process of working together, you suddenly find actually that you're solving a problem and not sort of looking at each other across the table as if you are the problem.
Yeah. And looking at British music as an export, of course we're here in the United States and British music is huge, so how do you see those revenues coming from overseas increasing over the past few years?
International revenue growth has been the source of our overall growth for a number of years now. With the decline in recorded media and the slow increase in the domestic broadcast and online markets, that's more or less been flat in total, and our growth has come from international. Well, now we're finding that there are some areas of the world where we're still seeing revenue growth. Yeah. We're finding that our artists are being ever more successful overseas. Yeah. But we're also finding there are some markets that are in real trouble. The recession in Southern Europe is really biting. And we've seen some unfavorable results from the rate courts here in the United States. So there are some ups and some downs. Last year was a challenge for us. We didn't do quite as well as we were hoping. And things are still looking a little tough. So there's two sort of elements. There's the balance between good and bad news. Yeah. And that's been a little bit more on the bad news recently than on the good news. And against that, there's this underlying trend where we're doing it better, better exchange of data, better cooperation. And that's got a slightly rising trend. And then the success of our artists. And that in the last few years has been absolutely unbelievable. If you think of Mumford & Sons, you think of Adele, you think it's just been, the whole host of them. I mean, Emily Sandy this year, it's just been fantastic.
And From the Sea Back to London, Music Connected, organized by the Association of Independent Music, was a great event, and I managed to record a bunch of short interviews with some of the panelists taking part. So first up, here's my chat with Laura Kirkpatrick from Spotify. First of all, how significant is the independent sector for Spotify? I know that you've been one of the services that has been most proactive in reaching out to independents.
I would absolutely agree with that. I think they are a huge part of the ecosystem for us. And we have very strong relationships with lots of indies and actually some of the most interesting campaigns that we do. For example, the Nick Cave app example that we talked about a little bit in the panel originate from indies. And I think that kind of freedom and that creativity that often comes from them and the entrepreneurial energy is absolutely vital to the innovation and trying new things on the service.
Of course. And you were talking about the social aspects of Spotify just then as a way to drive exposure for anybody, not just major acts, because of the way it works. Can you just elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So I think what the social developments within Spotify really mean is that because every user will see a bespoke, tailored homepage and experience, that means that, it doesn't just have to be the big artists that are the most visible. If you are an indie artist that just has 1,000 followers that you've worked hard to build up on your profile on Spotify by playlisting, by driving fans from other platforms that you may have, essentially those fans are more valuable to you than 100,000 who aren't interested in what you're doing. So that's really what our platform is taking into consideration as we evolve.
And also from Music Connected, an extract of my chat with the digital marketing manager, Lucy Blair.
And I mean, Sonos, of course, is a huge brand, you know, it's everywhere. And of course, you have to follow everything that's going on. But what is your single biggest social channel at the moment?
Our biggest channel is definitely, well, I guess it's between Facebook and YouTube, because we have two main Facebook pages, but we have several different YouTube channels. But Facebook overall is probably our number one.
Looking at the evolution of social media for music, of course, Twitter Music is something that is really being buzzing this week, and we don't yet know what it's going to be. In your fantasy football sort of game of social media and what you'd like to see on the service, what do you expect? What would you like to see?
Oh, such a good question. Well, first of all, I hope they release it soon, because I'm getting really annoyed with the teasing. I'm really, really fed up with that. Yeah, I just want to use it now. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation, obviously. There's been reports that the code in the Twitter Music page shows integrations with SoundCloud and Spotify and various different streaming services, which sounds great. Yeah. I mean, personally, this is slightly veering off the question, but personally, in terms of online music services, I think there's a big issue of a lack of interoperability between them. And I think it would actually be better for the music scene and better for artists and labels in general if the music services worked together more closely to cross-promote each other, because ultimately it's only going to do the music industry good. But I really hope that it's going to lead to easier music discovery, for a start, obviously. Better music curation across Twitter, kind of not just relying on, you know, a hashtag. And I guess, ultimately, from a marketing and sales point of view, it'd be great if you can discover new music and then purchase directly within the app as well. You know, I guess that's the ultimate goal.
And finally, a chat with Ebony Riney-James, head of digital marketing at Sony Music, recorded at the Ultimate Seminar.
Now, what do you feel like is the most important thing for young artists to look after when they're looking after their digital properties? As you know, as a young artist, you know, we're talking about with the creator of the BA here on Minster about the fact that anybody can create a Twitter account and maintain it, but it's very difficult to tie that into a strategy for a release. So, you know, what is the most important thing for a young artist to look at when they're doing that?
I think one thing a lot of artists do is they try and have everything. They want to have a Facebook, they want to have a Twitter, they want to have an Instagram, and you know, and actually some of those platforms don't work for all artists. And I think things like Facebook, for example, are important in terms of you know, people searching you out, but there's no point in you having a Twitter account and only tweeting once or having nothing to say, because people won't follow you. So I think people need to be really clear about who the artist is, it is that they are, and what they want to achieve before they kind of make a decision about what platforms they need to be on.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Looking at you know, the role of working at a major label for such big artists as well. So how have things changed in the last, you know, 3-4 years with the rise of streaming services, for example? Has that changed the strategies that you implement for a release as well?
Most definitely. And I guess one of the biggest changes is that we have less physical music stores. So actually, people being able to just go out and buy a record physically, you know, you don't have that option as much anymore. And I was at the BPI yesterday, actually, and we were talking about, in terms of, you know, the digital music's been around for, say, 10 years, but actually there's still a huge range of people that don't buy music digitally, and they might buy one compilation, and then an Now compilation might do, you know, one of the Now compilations will do 180,000 in a week, because there are a lot of people that aren't necessarily dedicated to one artist to buy one album, and actually they want something that's being curated. And the catalog market is very healthy at Sony Music. Our catalog department are amazing, and we sell a lot of records off of the back of catalog. So yeah, I think there's different things. I think streaming is very important as well. It's a new revenue stream for us. And I think that there are things that are happening. There's a lot of talk about YouTube subscription service, which will again change the way in which people are consuming music, say on YouTube or other platforms. Yeah, we have to, you know, especially within digital marketing, it's constantly evolving. So we definitely have to change our strategy to move with the market.
Of course, looking at digital marketing as well, I hear people sometimes say that, you know, it's no longer digital marketing, it's just marketing. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I try not to work in isolation. So, you know, there's this thing now called multi-screen viewing. You know, when you're watching a TV show, you're often on your iPad or your phone at the same time, or your laptop or your desktop. And I think it's detrimental to think about marketing or advertising in one way. And I think it's very much a joined. I think, you know, we all specialize in our areas, but the plan is that, you know, I want you to be able to see someone on TV and then automatically go online and be able to do something. And maybe you just go online and watch their video, and then you go to the supermarket the next day and you buy the record. It's not about, you know, one channel. It's about everything, you know, working together as one, and all elements are really important.
Absolutely. And it's also the case that in the last few years, because of, you know, this segmentation of the audience as well, things have changed in the sense that there's no longer a one formula fits all to release an album. You really have to think really carefully about who the audience is of the new artists that you have. For example, we saw Laura Mvula do incredibly well this year. And so I guess all of that marketing campaign was based around who the audience was, who do you wanted to reach, and how you went about doing that.
Yeah, I think if you talk about Laura Mvula specifically, she's an artist who's very original. She knew what music she wanted to make, and she didn't bend that for anything. I think that, you know, Sony have signed her knowing what she was about, and that was a risk. From my perspective, that's a risk, because she's not an obvious artist. You can't say, well, she fits here, and this is a radio station she'll be on, and, you know, but they were very creative. And Nadine Pasod, who I work with at Sony as well, very creative marketing campaign. I'm currently working on an artist called Foxes, who is amazing, and, you know, we see great things for her in 2014. She's done features with Zed on Clarity and also with Rudimental. Where she got one audience off the back of those collaborations. She also has her own core fan base. And recently we got a sync with Debenhams, which has increased her fan base by a whole new, you know, we're getting a whole new demographic of an audience off the back of that. So it's multi-tiered in that way.
And you've done a similar thing with Everything Everything, of course, last year.
Yeah, so I don't work Everything Everything directly, but again, that, you know, is a really interesting campaign, I think. You know, creatively, I'm obsessed with, you know, the way in which they're being marketed as well. You know, and then more recently with RCA, again, I don't work this band, but Codaline, you know, and me working with the Associated Labels division, we've got acts like Don Broco, who are a rock act, but very much can cross over into the mainstream in terms of, you know, the potential of the band as well.
And that's all for this recap of DMT's coverage of conferences around the world in 2013. I really hope you enjoyed this show, and I'd really like to thank you for your support of DMT throughout 2013. 2014 is going to be an amazing year in digital music, so stay tuned to keep up with all the latest. The normal DMT panel show will resume next week. Thanks so much for listening, have a great week, and until next time. And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.